My name's Chris Kirk, and this is TW Talks, the interviews podcast from 3 Weeks Edinburgh. I am at the Edinburgh Festival 2025. I'm sitting in the club bar at Assembly George Square, right at the heart of the fringe, and I'm going to be talking to performers who are appearing at this year's festival, talking past, present, and future, their journey in comedy to date, this year's show, and what is happening next. Today, Eli Matthewson, whose show Night Terror is on at Underbelly George Square. Let's get TW talking with Eli. We are back in the club bar at Assembly. I have my next guest here performing at the Edinburgh Fringe this year. Eli Matthewson's here to talk about his show Night Terror. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Here
this
we are.
This is quite exclusive. Is this the club bar in the club bar this, in the evening?
Technically, it's the lounge.
Okay.
The club bar lounge.
Yeah.
Secret bit at the back.
Yeah, the purple velvet couch you're on is really fancy.
Which I have a feeling outside of August is probably a story.
Yeah.
But for this month, it looks very plush.
Plush, yeah.
As is the way with Edinburgh. Every storeroom becomes an exclusive VIP bar. We are halfway through the fringe. I think the maths is more or less right on that. How is it going?
It's going well. I think I'm mentally a lot more stable than I have been previous years. And I've had my day off. So, you know, now it's just the full steam ahead to the end.
All the way through to the bank holiday weekend.
Mm-hmm.
So we are going to talk about this year's show. That is kind of what we're here to talk about. But before we get to that, past, present, future, let's talk in your journey in comedy so far. So we need to get quite condensed. But let's start at the start. When did it begin?
Here's where I reckon I was like, oh, I should be funny. For the school speech competition, when I was 9, I did a speech about the Spice Girls. They gave us like the list of topics that we were meant to talk about. And then just like the morning of, I was like, I don't want to talk about any of this. I want to do it about the Spice Girls. And then I essentially just did a roast of the Spice Girls, who weren't there, which was really, I mean, they're meant to be there for a roast. But I knew it went off because the next year, like 5 other students copied my speech. They did a speech about the Spice Girls. I was like, I'm a trendsetter.
Without wanting to age everybody in this conversation, what kind of proxy, what years are we talking about? I'm just trying to think, where in the Spice Girls trajectory was this onstage dissing coming?
Maybe towards the end. I was born in 88, so, and this must have been, towards the end of the 90s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they'd probably had their...
They've had Spice.
Had the movie come out?
Not sure about the movie.
Because that would have given you lots of material if you want to slag off.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. Oh, I don't know. I mean, the movie's got Richard E. Grant. And then from then on, I watched a lot of like Whose Line Is It Anyway when I was a kid. And then that made me go, oh, I'd love to do that job. And then there was theatre sports in my high school. And then in Christchurch, where I'm from, the theatre sports competition is like legit. It's very intense.
And so for people who don't know what theatre sports is, tell us what theatre sports is.
It's improv, but it's all the classics that you've seen on Whose Line Is It Anyway. So it's like you do your puppets, your word at a time story. You might do some song games. And then theatre sports is scored. Usually there's 3 judges who give you scores out of 5 or 10. And then, it was very much a great way for non-sporty kids to earn respect at their school.
Because it had sports in its name.
It had sports in the name, and you could win a trophy, and there were heats and a final, so people understood what it was. Whereas if you did the Shakespeare Festival, that did not translate. So I just did that, and then went to drama school after high school. And while I was at drama school, my friend James Roque, who's like a Filipino New Zealand comic who's now based in Canada, he'd been doing stand-up for maybe a year or so, and he was like, you should try it. And then I tried it. And then basically from when I graduated, that was the thing that was getting the most heat. So I just kept on going.
So you kind of name check some places here, but all this was happening in New Zealand, to clarify.
All this was happening.
Quite a long way away from where the Spice Girls were.
Yeah, exactly. As far away as you can get, but we still were into them. We had the Spice Girls, Chubba Chub. We had the Dolls. We were obsessed.
So once you decided stand up rather than or as well as improv?
It was alongside for a while, but stand-up sort of became the focus. Yeah. I mean, we still did. I was part of an improv troupe in New Zealand called Snort, which we brought over to Edinburgh a few times. And we did that for 10 years. But that improv show was more based. It was more a group of stand-ups doing improv. Yeah. everyone in that troupe pretty much was a comedian in their own right.
So even if you put theatre in the name anymore.
No, theatre was gone and sport was gone as well. You know, we divided ourselves.
And once you decided stand-up was the thing, was it immediately obvious what kind of stand-up you were going to do, what you're going to talk about, or did it take a bit of an experimentation to figure it out?
It took a wee while, I think, because I'd visited Edinburgh in 2012 as part of my like drama school work experience and seen a lot of shows and was just obsessed with so many different shows. That was the year Claudia O'Doherty did The Telescope, which yep. still remains like one of the best things I've ever seen. And I think for a while, especially as a theatre-trained person, I was like, oh, I probably will do more theatrical stuff. And I tried doing sketches, and I tried doing all sorts, and I used to do songs in my shows. And then, like, just the more it went on, the more the thing that I think suited me best and the challenge that I enjoyed the most was just, like, stand-up, just talking, telling stories, and trying to get them as funny as possible. Yeah.
So you mentioned long attachment to this here Edinburgh Festival. Mm. So in 2012, you were here doing some, well, watching shows,
and I was doing a play.
Oh, yeah. You were doing a play?
I was,
okay.
Yeah.
So let's skip.
Don't go back and read the reviews of that play.
Well, if we reviewed it 3 weeks, it'll be in the archives somewhere. But when was your first Edinburgh Fringe as a stand-up?
I think it must have been 2018. Yeah, first one was 2018. And it went all right, actually. Yeah. Yeah.
And prior to that point back in New Zealand, were you by that point doing the full hour regularly, or was that something new?
Yes, I'd probably done maybe 4 hours and maybe five even.
Blimey, New Zealand. Back in New Zealand, you cracked the crowd show.
But I wouldn't say those hours were all of quality. and I was fortunate in that when I first came to Edinburgh, I have five shows of which to pick and choose the quality material. Yeah, and I think the first show that I brought to Edinburgh was sort of the first show that I truly think was like, I guess, the final evolution of who I am as a stand-up. Like, yeah.
If you're in the comedy scene in New Zealand, is doing the Edinburgh Fringe something that most people aspire to, or is it something that feels a very long way away that you don't really understand?
It's very connected to the New Zealand comedy industry because we've got two main comedy prizes in our festival. One's called the Billy T Award, which is kind of not quite newcomer, but it's like a rising star award. And then the other one's the Fred Award, which is like best show. And the Billy T Award was the prize, I think, originally was like 10 grand in New Zealand dollars. And pretty much for the first years of that existing, most people would use that money to go to Edinburgh. So it wasn't like specifically said that that's what you do, but so many people did. And I think there's just been long connections. And I guess with acts like Rhys Darby and Boy With Tape On His Face, that the trajectory they had because of the Edinburgh Fringe, and especially Flight of the Conchords, that has really set this in the mind of New Zealanders. Yeah.
So are there lots of comedians for whom now Edinburgh, it is that, like for most UK comedians, up to a certain level, there's August, I have to go to Edinburgh, and therefore I've got to have another hour.
Or it just becomes like a badge of honour even to do it once, I think, and then come back, because so many people come and do this festival, and whether they've had a terrible time or a good time, they always come back to New Zealand like much better comedians. So therefore, I think people see it as this thing you've got to do. You've got to do the Melbourne Comedy Festival, you've got to do the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. Yeah, yeah.
In this year's show, you talk about, as well as all the stand-up and all the comedy back in New Zealand, in more recent years, you've been dabbling in sort of radio and sort of reality TV type stuff.
Mm.
How did that happen?
I guess, I don't even know. It was just like almost being in the right place at the right time. I think I got the radio job because someone left, and it was sort of in the middle of COVID, so there was a lot going on, and I just ended up with this job. I mean, a lot of it, I think, is from podcasting. I do a podcast with my friend Chris Parker, who's also at The Fringe for 2 days this weekend. We've been doing that for, like, coming up 10 years. We started in 2016. And that's the sort of thing that you just do for free for so long, and you don't know if it's even giving you any benefits. But it has, in terms of there's audience who come and see me here, and they're like, we're the podcast listeners, which is amazing. And then I think, yeah, getting the radio job, and we, as an offshoot of that podcast, we've made a couple of TV shows back in New Zealand. So, yeah, and those things have led to, I guess, slowly inching towards becoming mainstream New Zealand figures.
When you first did the podcast, you say 10 years ago, so podcasts have sort of been through a bit of buzz in the mid-2000s and then it all went away. And they got very excited, probably about 10 years ago. Suddenly I'm very excited about podcasts again. And then, of course, we're in an era where everyone has podcasts.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's really interesting. It's found audience for your live shows. It's open TV, radio work. Was that ever when you started, maybe this will help? Or was it literally, hey, wouldn't it be fun to talk for half an hour a week and stick it online?
I mean, the reason we started it is because we were both writers on John Owen Bean, which was like a comedy. It was a bit of everything. Like in New Zealand, every TV show is a little bit of everything because we have so few shows. So that was like a late night show with interviews and sketches and stand up. And, you know, it was a little bit of everything. And we were writers on that. And we just would never be cast in the same sketch or do anything together because they were like one gay person in each thing. And we found that.
That's the quota.
That's the quota. And for a long time, the panel show back home as well, I felt like that was the thing. One gay was on, the other gay couldn't be on. And so the podcast, I guess, was a way for us to actually just
interact.
Yeah, because we worked together so much off camera. And then, yeah, this was a way for us to be at the front, which was great.
So you're not doing the breakfast show with its early morning starts anymore?
No.
But how did you find being part of, it was quite a commercial radio station, I guess.
Really commercial. It was Top 40. It was a lot of Benson Boone. And that certainly was like, I don't know. I mean, I follow pop music, but I'm not like super keyed in. I don't care about things like the Kardashians. And that was a lot of what we had to talk about. And
you didn't get to use your Spice Girl dissing skills for new pop talent.
No, yeah. Well, I mean, I would, but I get in trouble for it. But I found it kind of, I mean, it almost worked out well because it was during COVID. So there was not a lot of performance opportunities going on outside. But I think I found it leached all of my creative energy because you're just having to come up with ideas constantly. It was like a 4-hour show and it's basically break, then song, then break, then song. And I mean, what's crazy is...
Well, and I think, I don't know, maybe there's only people who are old like me. Some people, I think, still picture the DJ picking the music
or
pressing a button on the computer and playing what someone else has already put.
Yeah. That's all done by someone else. That's all done by someone else. And so there was three of us and one of us was controlling the cues and when the ads play and stuff. But yeah, just you really got drawn into like your personal life has to be part of it. So it was always like, can we call your dad and talk about this? Can we call your mom? Can we call your partner? And I think that was like the worst bit for me was like, it's not just texting on me, it's texting on everyone in my life because they don't know when they're gonna get a phone call from the radio station pranking them. It was a lot of pranks.
And then that led into doing some of that sort of celebrity reality TV stuff.
Yeah.
And was that just it was easy money or did you think, actually, do you know what? I got to give this a go.
I first started Dancing with the Stars and that came up like, again, that was another opportunity that came up like the week before it started. They were like, do you want to give it a go? And it was the first time they'd done a same-sex couple on the New Zealand show, which was very exciting. And honestly, I really loved being a part of that because I just spent 30 hours a week learning to dance, which was crazy. You never get the opportunity as an adult to like learn a new skill. And that show was very nice and very fun. And to be honest, I had fun doing both reality TV shows because the other one was like Celebrity Treasure Island is very almost Survivor style. It's alliances, it's scheming. And to be honest, that sort of thing I do like. I like a mafia or a werewolf style game. And yeah, that was really fun. And I think as a comedian, when you're on a reality TV show, it's an amazing opportunity because if it's a celebrity one, a lot of the other people are sports stars or news broadcasters, and they don't really know how to be entertaining on camera. So it's an amazing opportunity to, every time you're doing
it. Yeah, rather than being in a room full of comedians.
Yes, like, yeah.
You're the person.
You've got a little starring opportunity. And you could tell, I could tell I was doing a good job because you do your interviews, like recapping the day's events. And I was like 12 days ahead of everyone else because they kept pulling me aside for my interview. So I was like, okay, I'm doing good. Doing good interviews on the show.
You do discuss some of this in the show, but the show is called Night Terror.
Yes.
So maybe explain to us where that bit comes.
So the Night Terror was not my Night Terror. It was my boyfriend's Night Terror. And he woke up in a panic one night because our friend was coming through the door thought it was an intruder, and he then thought I was an intruder as well, and he tried to strangle me. And that is the premise of the show, me unveiling that story. Yeah.
And you do give a bit more background in the show. People should go and see the show to get the it didn't quite happen completely out of the blue, but people come to the show to find out.
There's a bit of build up. There's a bit of things going on.
To justify.
Yeah. I've been really annoying.
But I guess also one thing you talk about is, I mean, obviously that's quite a traumatic experience, but also good material for a comedy show.
Yeah.
And I guess in the moment, how long between quite a traumatic experience for both of you to, hey, that's some great comedy. How quickly did that realization come?
That happened on a Sunday night. I think we went to our pub quiz on a Tuesday night, and I told everyone. And, you know, it's almost instantly you're like, okay, this story's got some legs. This story's got some legs. And that's, yeah, I guess that's the toxic trait of every comedian, is anytime anything happens, instead of dealing with it in an emotionally responsible way,
you're thinking, deal with it on stage.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
When you do Edinburgh shows now, is it pulling stuff you've been doing throughout the year elsewhere? Or do you say, do you know what, I'm going to do a whole new show. I'm obviously not necessarily debut at Edinburgh, but there's a new show that I should have ready in August.
Yeah, I guess I'm like right now in a transition stage because I've moved to the UK just very recently. And so ordinarily it would be debuting a show in New Zealand or in Melbourne, and then you do it all through. Yeah, there's like Melbourne, then Sydney, then Brisbane.
The various festivals and stuff happening in this
and that corner of the world, yeah. And then bringing it here. And so that's been the way that I've operated. I'm not sure what happens from here, because either, yeah, I might go back and do the Australian festivals, or now that I'm in the UK, it feels like I should be, I don't know, using that time to base myself in the UK. So I imagine maybe next Edinburgh, that will be a debut show. And it is always, yeah, looking back at the year or looking back at like one, often it's not maybe something that's happened in the year, but there's just like something from my life that is just circulating around the mind. One thing I've got at the moment is I used to be on like a message board about Australian Idol. And it was like literally me, I was 14, and me and a bunch of 40-year-old mums. And I was in this community and the show finished. And then I just stayed on this message board chatting to these mums all the time. And I've got everything I ever wrote I found, because it's still online. And so that's the thing that I now have like put to the side, is like maybe that's the next show. But yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about future plans. I mean, do you have future plans for this show? Or are you planning on touring this show beyond?
I believe I am. I don't know if it's been confirmed. I'm doing the show, I think, at Underbelly in London in September. And then not sure what from there. Ideally take it around a few more places. But yeah, I mean, my plan from here is just to try and perform as much as possible in the UK. Go to some places I've never been before. Yeah, and
yeah, so whether that's with this show or just generally,
or just generally gigging, yeah, that's the plan. Get to know the scene, get to know people, hopefully. Yeah, that's,
well, let's just finish off by reminding people of the listing information for the rest of the Edinburgh run.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me venue, time, etc.
So I'm at the Underbelly Wee Coo. It's right by the Big Purple Cow. It's 8:50 every night, Underbelly George Square, and yeah, that's it. It's every night to the end of the fringe, 8:50.
And where can people find you online?
They can find me, Eli Mathewson, on Instagram, or I'm also on TikTok. You'd have to search my name. It's got a number at the end, but I can't remember what it is.
Just keep going up.
Or Eli Mathewson Comedy on Facebook. Sorry, I deleted my Twitter account. I couldn't handle it anymore. But yeah, Instagram's probably my main way.
Good place to start. Well, thanks very much for joining us.
A pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.